Okay, welcome to another installment of Why Do We Do That? Where we try and figure out why we do things in Judaism. This week we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of things that have to do with mourning. See how much of this we can get done. And I put it on the sheet here, it's in memory of Shlomo ben Aryeh HaKohen, who's my grandfather, passed away last week. Aunt is here as well. So unfortunately I had occasion to review a lot of the stuff recently, and so I wanted to look at a couple of these things. There's a lot. The halachas of mourning are a very interesting area of halacha in general, because there's a lot of very intricate practices and stuff and different little detailed things that we do, and as opposed to other areas, it's an area where what we actually do very often does not correlate to what it says we should do anywhere. It's very strange. Actually had this debate, like, during the Shiva, there was something that we were talking, like, should we say this, should we not say this? So I looked it up, and in the book that I have, it says you should say it. And then the people that were there said, no, I don't think we do, whatever. So I asked someone about it later, and he said, yeah, it says in the book that you're supposed to say it. We don't say it. There's all kinds of stuff. It's like that. It's a very interesting area of halacha, more so than other areas of halacha, where what we do is very tradition-oriented as opposed to sort of normative text-oriented. The two things I wanted to look at today are kriya, tearing of garments, and comforting mourners, nichum avelim, which are, not... They're both things that you come up with, that you encounter when we are dealing with the laws of Avelut. So I think the basic question, just in terms of background, that we need to ask in terms of all of the halachas of Avelut is that somebody passed away, and it's a traumatic experience, and the question is, how are we supposed to react to it, right? We have, how are we supposed to react to it in a psychological sense, in the sense that we're trying to cope with the situation? And how are we supposed to react to it? It's also a very significant religious event. Somebody's life ended. It's a very deep and emotional event. So from a religious perspective, how do we do? What do we do? We want to do something to commemorate what happened, to mark the occasion. How do we do it? What are we supposed to do? Hello. Do we need more chairs? There's enough chairs?
We have two chairs. Somebody?
Yeah. I'll sit over there beside the man.
So that's the question that we have. If we're dealing with mourning, how do we react to the event, the fact that somebody passed away, psychologically, religiously? And that's really what we want to know. We want to know what to do, and the question is what to do leaves us sort of groping, like where do we look to figure out what we're supposed to do? And as I mentioned before, this is an area where very often the practices that we have are sometimes at odds with the sources that we have, but what we're doing today is basically based in sources, at least as much as we're going to look at today. So the first thing that I wanted to look at was kriya, the practice of tearing your clothes. You tear your clothes as a response of mourning. And the question is, where did we get this idea from? So if one looks through Tanakh, if you read through the Bible, you find all over the place that people are tearing their clothes for a variety of different reasons. They're tearing their clothes when they hear about bad news. They're tearing their clothes when they hear about somebody dying. They're tearing their clothes all over the place. As we see, it's actually in this week's Parsha. You see that the brothers are coming to Yosef, and they're sort of cornered, right? He sets up this very elaborate situation where he puts his cup in the sack of the youngest brother, Binyamin, and he says, I'm just going to take the person who took my cup and make him my slave. And Yehuda tears his clothes. He tears his clothes in response to the news. So it's some kind of reaction. where do we see this specifically in terms of mourning? So that we find in this first source here. And the first source that we have is in the story of the Miluim of the Mishkan, much later in the Torah than we are at now in terms of the Parsha. We're dealing with the inauguration of the Mishkan, the sanctuary. We spent all this time preparing this sanctuary, and there's a very elaborate 8-day ceremony where they're preparing to start using it, they're inaugurating it, and two of Aaron's sons die. We see this description here. Vayikhu bnei Aaron Nadav Aviu Ishmach Tato, Vayitnu Vahan Esh, Vayasimu Aleik Torah, Vayikrivu Lifnei Hashem Eich Sarah, Asher Lo Tzivah Otam. They each took an incense thing, and they put fire on it, which they had not been commanded to do. Why they did this and what happened here is a very interesting discussion in its own right, but the response was, V'teitze Esh Milifnei Hashem, V'tochal Otam Vayamutu Lifnei Hashem. A fire came out from before God and consumed them, and they died. So again, why that happened and what the justification and what's going on there is not important, not for our purposes right now, but they died, which means now Aaron has two of his sons who died, and his brothers have, you know, two brothers that died. So presumably, pardon?
His two sons.
Right, two of his sons died. Yeah. So he had Aaron. I don't know if these sons had sons already. I don't think so. But he had other sons. So the brothers had brothers that died, and Aaron had sons that died.
His only children.
Right. He had other sons as well. So then that's what we see here. What is the response to this? What do you do? So Moshe tells some of the other family members to remove the bodies, and then Moshe tells Aaron, this is in Vav here, which is 6 in the translation, Vayomer Moshe el Aaron ula Elazar li Tamar banav. So Moshe told Aaron and Elazar and Itamar, his other two sons who were also Kohanim there, Roshechem al tifra'u, Bigdechem al tifromu velo tamutu. Don't let your hair grow long, don't grow out your hair, and don't rip your clothes, and you will not die. Val kol ha'eda yiktzof, v'acheichem kol beit Yisrael yivku et ha'srifa asher saraf Hashem. And God will get, don't die and cause God to be angry with the whole nation. Instead, the other Jews, the rest of the people, will cry for the people that died. But you are in the middle of this very important ceremony, and you have what you're doing now is of national importance, and you can't stop what you're doing now to engage in practices of mourning, so you have to keep doing whatever you're doing, and you can't react right now, and everyone else will react for you, but you have to continue with what you're doing. So what we see here, by implication, is that these two acts which are described here, growing out your hair and tearing your clothes, are things that you would do if you were going to react in mourning. Right, they're told not to do this. Don't do this now because of the circumstances. But that implies that in general, you should be doing it. And in fact, if we look in source 2, in the Talmud, this is the inference that's made. It's a little bit more extreme than maybe is logically granted. We'll maybe discuss that in a minute. But we see, Amar Rav Tachlifa Bar Avimi Amar Shmuel, Avel Shalo Para V'Shalo Pirem, a mourner who does not grow out his hair and doesn't tear his clothes, chayav mita, he's liable for death. How do you know? Because of what we just saw. Shneamar, that it says in the Torah, roshechem al tifru, ubigdechem lo tifromu, velo tamutu vegomer. Don't grow out your hair and don't tear your clothes so you don't die. Ha'acher shelo par v'shelo pirim chayav mita. This implies that somebody else who didn't grow out their hair and didn't tear their clothes is liable for death. So if you think about that carefully, it actually logically doesn't make sense. The Torah says that you, the Kohanim, in this circumstance can't do this, because if they do this, then they'll be liable for death for whatever reason, because they're involved in the Mishkan and they shouldn't be doing this. That doesn't mean that in general, if somebody doesn't do this, that they should be liable for death. It doesn't actually follow logically. All it follows is that normally speaking, you should do this. We don't know what the consequences are for not doing it in general. And that actually sparks a little bit of a debate here. Are we saying that this is, you know, like you have to do this, you're going to be punished if you don't do it? But it sounds like, it's certainly what the Talmud gets out of this story, is that a mourner, this is part of the practice of mourning, growing out your hair and also tearing your clothes. Okay. And so we see that in terms of finding a basis for what we're doing, we looked back in the story in the Torah. We're trying to figure out how to respond in terms of mourning. So we looked back at a story in the Torah, and we used that story to try and inform what we're doing. And if we and for a lot of the halakhas of Kriya, which are very long and very complicated, interestingly, many things are basically uncovered by looking back at precedents. We look back to stories in Tanakh and try and figure out what people were doing and see what people were doing and use that as the basis for our practice. So if you see in source 3, there's just another example. There are many other examples. You're supposed to do the kriya while you're standing. You're supposed to stand up and then do the tearing. How do we know that? Why should that be so? So Amar Rabbi Bar Chama, minayin lekriya shehi me'umad. How do we know that tearing, that kriya has to be done while you're standing? Shenemar vayakam Iov vayikra. We quote from Iov, the book of Iov. In the story in Iov, he finds out that his whole family, all of his children, were killed in a horrible accident. It's a question if the story actually happened or it didn't happen, whatever in that case. But at least in terms of the description, he finds out that this happened, and he does two things. He gets up and he tears his clothes, and then it says he shaves off all of his hair. He goes rosho, he shaves off his hair. So how do we know that you have to do kriya while you're standing up? Because in the story of Yehov, it says that he stood up, and then he tore his clothes. So evidently, you have to stand up when you tear your clothes. And so the Gemara counters, maybe that's not true. Maybe he was going beyond the call of what you need to do. Because if you don't say that, Dilma Milta Yeterta Hu Da'avad, he did something beyond the call of what he needed to do. Dilo Teimahachi, if you don't say so, Vayigoz et Rosho Achinami, then maybe we should learn from there that everyone has to shave off all their hair also, which we don't do. Ela Mahacha, so we grab a reference from a different story from King David. King David had an event where one of his sons killed another one of his sons, and he actually thought that they had all died. Someone had killed all of them. He got news, a message that all of his sons had died, and his response was that he stood up and tore his clothing.
Was
yeah.
he Jewish?
So,
which is why I'm asking, because you know it may not have been a custom that Jews did what he did.
Right, so that's an interesting question.
No, in the story, there's no mention that he's Jewish.
Yeah, so was Iov... It's unclear exactly when the... there's a bunch of different views about the... You know, what the story is, what the deal is with Iov. One view is that it's a totally... The most radical view is that it's totally all an analogy. So presumably, if it's an analogy, it's still an analogy which follows proper Jewish custom, right? It's part of Tanakh, it's written with whatever intentions... there are other perspectives, I think, that Iov lived in the times of the Avot, of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which was much earlier. So then it's sort of like a proto-Jewish kind of situation, which is a fair question. Clearly, this Gemara is assuming that we could have used this as a source for our practice today. So I don't know how that plays out in terms of what this Gemara is assuming about.
It just seems like, I know,
but you're right.
It came at the end of the Tanakh, and it's so contrary to what other Chumash sources are for mourning.
Right.
I mean, shaving your head.
Right. So that's not something that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
It's the opposite. Sometimes you find those things, you know, in sort of like in tandem with each other. Shaving your hair as opposed to growing out your hair. Make your hair look strange. Okay, but you're right. It is literally the opposite of growing your hair out.
Maybe one was a reaction to the other.
It could
maybe
be.
Allowing your hair to grow and dafka not cutting it is a reaction to maybe the pagan...
The practice of shaving all
of
your
hair.
Yeah.
It's possible.
This is a dafka. You know, like, this is what we're not doing.
Right. It's possible. So, in any event, we revert to this source from King David, that he stood up and tore his clothes, so you see that you have to stand up and tear. But this is just another example of us trying to figure out how we're supposed to do this, and we go back to precedent that we found before. So, in terms of what we actually do for the Kriya, so I have a few of the details here. But the basic rule is, if somebody has a relative who dies, I mean, there's a bunch of other cases of kriya, but let's talk about this one. Somebody has a relative who dies, this person has to tear their clothing, they have to do kriya, and it has to be done standing up, and you can't do it sitting down because of this source that we understand. We'll talk about what the reason for this is, and how does this maybe play out in terms of why we're doing this, but you see that the details that we're grabbing are from precedent. So some of the rules here, it's very long. There's 39 different little clauses in the Shulchan Aruch to describe the laws of kriya. It's very long and very complicated. And as I said, many versions, many instances of kriya we don't practice today at all. So for example, in the Shulchan Aruch we describe kriya that you do if you're present for the death. Somebody's there at the death, then you're supposed to tear your clothing. Even if you're not related to the person, but you're present for the death, that's something that's not really practiced today either. And there's different kinds of person has their, you know, their Rebbe Muvhak, their main principal teacher passes away. So there, I mean, that actually still is practiced. People do kriya there, not just for parents. And there's a lot of different cases. We'll just go through some of the rules here. Makom kriya b'kol makom b'beit hatzavar lefanav. The place of the kriya is on the neck of the garment and towards the front, but if you tear on the back, you tear from the hem of the garment, that's not okay. There's two details here which are shira kriya is a tefach, it's a hand breadth, which is like that much, or so, maybe a little bit less than that. The two rules which will be significant for us later in terms of thinking about the reasoning here are the number of garments that you tear, that you're wearing, and also there's this rule about stitching up the garment afterwards. So al kol hametim korea alav tefach bebeged ha'alion v'dayo. Generally speaking, you tear on the outermost garment that you're wearing, and that's it. You don't have to do anything else. So if you're wearing, a shirt and some other and a sweater and some whatever other stuff, you would only tear whatever is outermost. Jackets are an interesting debate. Do you tear a jacket? Do you not tear a jacket? But that's not for now. Al avi ve'imo, for one's parents, your korea kol begadav. You rip all of the garments that you're wearing, with the exception maybe of an undershirt. Afilu hu lavush yud. Even if you happen to be wearing 10 garments, you tear all of them. Ad shemegale libo, until you reveal your heart. Vim lo kara kol begadav lo yatsa. And if you don't tear all of your clothing, you haven't properly fulfilled what you need to do. V'gorim bo, and people sort of nudge you. V'kol zman she'oto beged alav omrim lo kara. And all the time that anytime the person is wearing that clothing, the clothing they're wearing when this chiyuv started, when they had to do the tearing, people say you should tear, even if it's after 30 days after the death. Yeah.
Got a question for you. You know, the Hebrew word we use when somebody's died is niftar, or niftar, or whatever, which I've understood to mean it's sort of torn, torn of a limb, or, you know, niftar. Is it that it's what we're doing with clothes is sort of symbolic of that tearing?
I think that if tearing would be like tarof, nitraf, to be torn up. I think.
Well, niftar, I thought niftar.
Niftar means, I think, to be, usually means to be exempted or to be passed. I think it's literally translates to passed away, if I'm not mistaken.
Niftar?
I could be wrong. Okay. But there is certainly a concept of a person passing away. The Gemara has a description of the soul sort of departing, soul sort of separating from the body.
Right.
That a person who dies, and it depends on the kind of person, the personality. Right, some people, it's like pulling a thorn out from a ball of wool. That's the description.
But it doesn't say what,
and for some people, it's like a hair out of
Right, but it doesn't say so far why we tear.
Right, so we'll get there.
Okay.
So that's coming. But so we'll look at some of the rules, and we can build a stronger.
I have a question. If you're tearing for like a Rebbe that you admire and you learned with, and you tear a clothing, so then how long would you wear that shirt for? Right. You're not saying shiva. You're
correct.
So what happens?
Right. So the rule, I think, in general, is that the people that are sitting shiva have to be wearing torn clothing throughout the shiva.
Right.
That's the rule of tearing during shiva. In that case, in the case of a person's Rebbe, I think you would tear the clothing and then you can change it later and you don't have to.
But isn't the whole idea that your Rebbe, your teacher is like your parent?
Yeah. but not literally like your parents.
Oh,
in
it's
this
not.
Regard.
Okay.
I mean, so you yeah. are tearing for them in
right.
similar way to your
right.
parent, but not. Okay. So that's one rule. Al kol ha-meitim sholel, and so the other rule is that for other relatives, after 7 days, you can do sort of rough stitching where you sort of close the thing more or less. Uma'achel achar shloshim yom. 30 days after the death, you can totally restitch the garment and try and make it, you know. And back in the day, they would just try and fix it and they would keep using it, right? You wouldn't necessarily get new clothes. Al avi ve'imo sholel achar lamed yom. For one's parents, you can do this rough stitching after 30 days. Ve'eino ma'achel olam. But you can never try to re-stitch it back together the way that it was before.
Do the clothes have to be woven? If you're wearing leather or any other thing, like it makes it sound like it has to be a woven fabric.
I don't think so.
It could be anything?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
There are cases where that's relevant, like for tzitzis, that's a big, it's important halakha that it has to be a beged, which is made out of woven stuff. I'm not
right.
sure that's true.
Okay.
Here.
So it says here, it makes no difference if a holiday occurs during the 3 days.
Right.
So if you're if you lost a sibling or a child or God forbid, right, and a holiday happens during the shloshim,
yeah,
then the mourning's over,
right.
So why would you still wear a garment for 30 days?
I mean, you don't have to, even if you're not wearing the garment. That's, I think, the distinction here is this is a rule which pertains to the garment. Like, you could not be wearing it. You're not allowed to try and fix it, to
this
start fixing it
oh, okay.
until afterwards. Even though you're right, the mourning per se is over, but in terms of fixing the garment, you're not allowed to do that until after that time. Okay, so that's what we have. We have some of the rules, we have some of the historical background, many of the other rules, which is complicated as they are, also come out of historical context, some of them don't. Why do we do this? That's, you know, important. We have to try and understand why exactly is this happening. So there are a series, a few different answers that I've found, which are interesting. There are more also, but I just brought a few samples here. We'll look at a few, and I think they're quite meaningful in terms of how they emerge. The first idea comes in all places in the laws of Shabbat. Why? Why are we talking about this in the laws of Shabbat? Because on Shabbat, you're not allowed to do productive activity. Malacha, which is, you're not allowed to do work which is productive. What is considered productive? There are certain categories of things that we're not allowed to do, which at face value are not productive, like destroying a building, or putting out a fire, or tearing something. If you tearing something is one of the malachas, one of the actions that you're not allowed to do, but it's totally not productive, right? If I just have a piece of, like I just take a piece of paper and I rip it into shreds, I didn't do anything. I took a garment and just ripped it because I, for no reason at all, then I didn't do anything productive. So if the rule is, if you do an action and it's purely what's called mekalkel, you just want to destroy it for no reason, that's not considered productive activity, which is a problem on Shabbos. But what if you... So how exactly do you end up in a situation where ripping something is a problem? So we have here, this is source number 5 from the Rambam, where he talks about this. The classic case is the first thing that he has here. HaKorea kedei litfor shtei tfirot, al menat litfor shtei tfirot chayav. So if you... The classic case of ripping something is... I'm not a big... This is a little bit embarrassing given my family history, but I'm not exactly sure why this is true. But sometimes you want to rip a piece of clothing and so that you can stitch it back together and it'll be more effectively stitched. It's warped or it's... I don't know if to ask my dad. My family's been in like textile for many generations and I don't understand how this works. But if you... There is some sort of situation where you would want to rip it in order to stitch it back together. So if you're ripping it and there's this much... you have enough, it's a long enough tear to put 2 stitches inside, and your goal in ripping it was in order to put the stitches in, that's a problem on Shabbos. That's called productive ripping. What if I'm very angry, or I'm mourning, and I have to do the ripping for the mourning purposes? What if I do that? Is that considered productive or not? So that, the Rambam says, is also productive. So he says, this first case of ripping for the stitches is a problem. Avala korei lehafsida Pater mifneshu makalkal. If you rip something up just to destroy it, then you're not, you didn't break, maybe you shouldn't do it, but you didn't break Shabbos per se because you're just destroying it wantonly. But hakorea b'chamato, o al menat shu chayav likro alav, or al mate, sorry, shu chayav likro alav, chayav mipnei, we'll get to the mipnei in a second. So somebody who tears because they're angry, or because they have a relative that they must tear for, that person did break Shabbos. Why? Mipnei shemei yashev edato bedavar zeh. Ve'enuach yitzro, because this person settles their mind. It settled their mind, and he calms his spirit by doing this. V'holu chamato shochachat, since his anger is abated through this action. Bedavar zeh harehu kemitakin. So that is a productive activity. It's a productive form of ripping. I didn't, you know, the physical product that I have at the end is not any different. That's not what I produced, but I produced a change, psychological, emotional change in myself. And that is also considered productive, and that would be a problem on Shabbos. But so this is a, you know, not directly related to what we're talking about, but as a tangent, we see from here the description. What exactly are you doing when you make this tear? So part of the idea, certainly according to this view in the Rambam, is to try and deal with your pent-up emotions. I have emotions that are very strong, anguish, I'm grieving and I'm upset, and you tear your clothing as a response to that anger to try and calm yourself down, to try and settle your mind a little bit in terms of the feelings that you have.
Therapeutic.
Yeah, so it's like a therapeutic action. I tear my clothing. So that's one view that we have here.
But right? Usually, you don't usually do the tearing, though.
Yeah, someone else might start it for you. Someone else might even do it for you. So
yeah,
that's true.
That's
a fair point.
Yeah,
that's true.
Well,
I mean, if you...
Yes. During Kriya, it's rarely torn. They use a knife or a blade.
Yeah.
So is that...
They start... I mean, certainly they start it with a knife. Often it's very hard to start it yourself. I think the rest of it is done. At least part of it has to be done by hand. So that's a very good point. If you look through the examples in the Tanakh, it doesn't say that Yehuda was very upset, so he called the rabbi, and the rabbi came cut a little thing into his shirt, and then he ripped it. It says he ripped his clothes. Everybody, all the times we see this described. So if you're going to follow this view purely, you have to say that, you know, we reach sort of like very technical stage in our historical evolution here, where you want to make sure you do it right, and that's more important than actually doing the ripping yourself. Which is a little bit interesting, because that's kind of self-defeating.
Maybe different sort of fabrics at that time as well.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's true.
You know, the Torah much easier than the current fabric.
It's probably, that almost, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised. Okay, so that's one view that we have here. Then we have the exact opposite view. This that we'll see in a second, in this shoot, it's a responsa from Beit Yehuda. But he points out something very interesting. He says, we saw a story before, the first source that we saw, from the sons of Aaron and Aaron himself. They weren't allowed to do this ripping because they weren't allowed to be in mourning during the inauguration of the sanctuary. But if the point of the ripping is to make me feel better, I'm not mourning anymore, it's to make me get rid of my feelings of mourning, so then they should have been allowed to rip as much as they wanted to. The whole point was, we don't want you to be in mourning. You shouldn't be mourning now. You should be engaged in whatever work you have to do, and therefore you can't rip. But if ripping is going to make you feel better, and then you can get back to whatever you needed to be doing, then they should have been allowed to tear their clothes. So he says on this basis that it's actually the exact opposite. That really the point of the tearing is to make you upset. So we'll see this inside now, and then we can talk about it afterwards again. Be'inyin hakriya, so katav harav b'halachot ketanot, he quotes another source which says something along the lines of what we just saw from the Rambam. Betam hakriya, the reason for tearing your clothes, hu kedei shelo titaref da'at olav, so a person won't lose their mind in terms of their grief. La'aniyut da'ati nira ipcha, in my humble opinion, it seems the opposite is true. De'adarabba, kedei she'yorir atzmo bebechi ulehaflig tza'aro. And the point of it is in order to arouse himself to be upset, and to sort of increase his suffering, perhaps. Dumia, Deshar Mine Chiyuvin Shechayvu La'onenu La'avel. Similar to all the other things that we make a mourner do, they have to wear different kinds of shoes. They do all kinds of different things to demarcate the fact that now we're in mourning. So just like you have to do those things, you have to tear your clothes also. All of them are designed in order to increase or create a context where the person can effectively grieve. Yeah.
I can't help think that we're sort of missing something. You know, the way, Khalilah, when somebody dies, when you have to rip our clothes, it's almost done clinically. In other words, you know, someone will cut, and truly, I don't know how you can really feel the kind of anguish that would have aroused somebody in the time of the Tanakh to have ripped their clothes out of anger, or frustration, or mourning, or grief, or whatever. It seems that it's not... What we're doing today is really just a symbol, because I don't think we're getting at really what is the essence of what tearing really is all about.
Right. So hold that thought for a minute. That's a very good point. Let's finish the source. We can talk about this. You're right. But I think the last kind of reason that I'm going to address probably fits best with what we do today. So he says the point of it is to increase your tsar. And you can sort of understand if a person is actually ripping their clothes, it's a jarring experience. It's not something you normally do, to like sit there and just, you know, tear your... And somebody sees this, it's even more jarring. So that's the point of it. The point of it is actually to create a situation where you're mourning. V'yalfinan lam Aaron. We learn this from Aaron and his sons. Dichtiv roshechem al tifru v'chule. The Torah says, don't grow out your hair, etc. Don't rip your clothes. V'hatam v'day lo ratzah makom shi'itztaru al meiteyem. And in that case, we know for sure that God didn't want them to suffer, to be worried about their, to be grieving during that time. That was the whole point of that message from Moshe, that God didn't want them to be doing this. Now you have to focus on what your task. V'itam akriya hi lehaflig hatzar, adaraba haya mazhiran betzav letzav likroa. And if the purpose... maybe it could be mistranslated, or there's a word which is not correct here. If the purpose of it was to increase, or maybe it means to alleviate their suffering, then on the contrary, it should have told them explicitly to tear, because that would have been good. Elevada kedikativna. Rather, it's as I have written. So he wants to argue the opposite extreme, that the purpose is to make yourself feel upset. So the question that we have to ask is, how would the Rambam respond to this challenge? And the Rambam knows, he read the Torah. He knows that it says in the Torah that Aaron's sons were told not to tear. So why would he say that tearing means to alleviate my suffering, if that would have fit very nicely, that Aaron's sons should have been told to alleviate their suffering? And the answer, I think, is that there's another layer to this as well. Aside from maybe the fact that this will get rid of a little bit of your pain, and you just think about it reasonably. You have to tear your clothes and wear them for 7 days. Are we really suggesting that the one tear that you do is going to deal with all of your suffering that you're experiencing, your mourning right now? Like, that's not reasonable, right? That's not really going to accomplish that. So why is it that you have to tear and you have to show people that you tore, and if you're sitting Shiva, it has to be there for 7 days? That doesn't fit. If the whole point is just to stimulate some kind of emotion at the moment when I do the tearing, then a lot of these rules don't make sense. I have to tear all the way down to my heart. I have to leave it there. I can never stitch it back up. What's going on? So I think that there's another element as well, and that element is that in addition to whatever emotional effect this has for the person, this is like a badge. This is like a symbol that then this fits very well with what you're saying, that this is like something that you're showing everybody else. I'm in mourning. I'm so upset that if I had my druthers, I would just keep ripping the shirt again and again and again and again and again. I would just keep ripping it all the time. I have to communicate that. And we see that borne out by some of the rules of Kriya as well. In the Rambam himself, he says, first of all, he explicitly quotes this story about Aaron's sons in source 7. Chayev likroa al meito. A mourner has to tear for their loved one, their relative who passes away. Shenemar ubigdechem lo tifromu velo tamutu. He quotes the story from Aaron's sons. You can't. They couldn't rip their clothes lest they die. Ha'acher chayev lifrom. Somebody else does have to tear their clothes.
Is it because they were Kohen Gadol?
It's because they were involved in the middle of... The Kohen Gadol also has separate rules,
yeah.
But these Kohanim, since they were involved right now in inaugurating the Mishkan, they couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. Normally speaking, a Kohen does have Velux.
Sorry to interrupt, but on that point, is that where we get the idea also that you don't mourn into a chag? Because if they were dedicating the Beit HaMikdash, this is a big deal. This is right up there with, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Pesach, so such that it would have existed. So if this is a time of national, and by national I mean Am Yisrael,
right.
This is a time of national celebrating, this is exactly when, if you're mourning, your Shiva gets...
Right, so you're right that the basic logical rule, I'm not sure if this example is quoted, but that's the logic. You have an individual mourning, and then you have a national holiday. The holiday, which is for everybody, cancels out, overrides the mourning of the individual. That's the rule, that's how the Gemara formulates it. Yavo simcha derabim v'yivatel aveilut yachid. The joy, of national joy, should override the individual person's mourning. So you're... I'm not sure if this is quoted as the example, but it does make sense.
It
fits
sense.
In. Yeah. Okay. So you see that there, in source 8 and 9, we have two rules which indicate that the tearing is really supposed to be something which is also for everybody else. One of the examples is if you have a small child, who has a relative that passed away that would cause them to have to do kriya, you tear the clothing for the child. Not because they have to do it, but for everybody else's anguish, because they see a child who had to tear their clothes, God forbid. And that causes anguish for everybody else, so that rule clearly has nothing to do with this person alleviating their suffering, specifically because it's probably a child who's too young to understand what's going on at all, because if he's old enough, that he or she is old enough to understand, then maybe you have to teach them about it. So if they're so small they can't understand, that's really for everybody else. And we also see a rule, if you go out, kol hayotze bebeged karua lifnei meitim, klomar shukara tanaleya, and anyone who goes out with already torn clothes, I've got my Shiva shirt, my funeral shirt that I wear, and I want to show everybody how upset I am about the death, so I have the shirt that's already torn, and I wear that one, that is really not, you know, it's not nice. It's not a good thing. Hareza gonevda tabriot. This person deceives everybody, and he's actually belittling the honor of the living and the dead. Why? Because the whole point of having the torn shirt is to show I was so upset about this that I tore my clothes. And look, I have my torn clothes. I want to show everybody. And if you go out with your clothes that were already torn, then you're pretending that you're so upset about it that you tore your clothes, but you didn't actually. Maybe you would have anyway, but you didn't actually do that. You're sort of like, it's like being deceptive about it. But both of those rules indicate that there's an element here of showing everybody else that I'm this upset. So what we have here is basically three kinds of reasons. One is that there's some sort of, one, the first one's maybe two-sided, that there's some sort of emotional response. Either it's a response to my emotions, or it's to stimulate my emotions in terms of the mourning. And also, I think, which is very important, is that I'm showing everybody how upset I am. And it sort of plays into the two rules we saw before about the number of clothes that you tear and when you can stitch them back up, right? When you have a relative, so you tear, it's horrible, and you tear your top layer of clothing. When you have one's parents, so you're showing this is a total, my existence has been totally undermined by this loss, so I have to tear everything. I tear everything that I'm wearing all the way down to my heart. And similarly, in terms of stitching things back together again, so relative dies, it's terrible, and over time you move on. And the idea for the parents is that you can never stitch that back up. I don't even pretend that I could ever fix this breach, so I have to leave it even in the clothes. If you keep them in your closet, they have to be torn forever, yeah.
I hear you. I mean, the other thing is that because it's married to the idea of letting your hair grow, to me, it becomes more of a sign of identification. In other words, that you are, the norm is keep your hair, for men anyway, keep your hair, I guess, short, whatever, and wear proper clothes that are not ripped. And any differing from that would mean that you're sort of pulling yourself out of the ordinary milieu of the people around you, and thus, for example, so you can't look at yourself how bad you look. So, you know, the idea becomes more that, you know, this is a means of identification of grief externally, because you can't grieve excessively, but nevertheless you can grieve, but it's more a sign of identification as opposed to anything else. In other words, here is before us a mourner, and we can evidently see that he has the signs of mourning. Kilui keeps his hair long, and he has a ripped cloak, because otherwise he would be properly kept.
So that's for sure an element also, and I'm not sure how different that is from the last reason here. I mean, in terms of showing to everybody that you're in mourning, right? I mean, do you just mean this in terms of just identifying him in society?
Yeah, because, you know, otherwise he would keep his hair neat, keep his hair short, whatever. It's married to the idea of not cutting one's hair.
Right, that's true that the two things are...
So in other words, exactly, you're stepping out, you know, you're changing your routine, just like your life has been changed because of the death of, God forbid, somebody.
Okay, so I hear that, for sure. We'll see reference to it maybe a little bit later, but yes, I definitely hear. There's definitely more reasons to discuss here, mm-hmm. and there's a lot more angles here, especially given the number of details there are in these halachas. Mm-hmm. So granted, that's...
The truth is, because you're not tearing your clothes for 7 days, you're tearing your clothes once.
You're wearing the same clothes. You would, in theory, you would. If you put on new clothes, you have to tear them again.
But you don't. You shouldn't put on new clothes.
But one more
new
clothes, just closing your closet.
Quick question.
No, you just put on anything
we
fresh.
We don't tear down 10 layers. We don't tear down more than one layer, even for parents.
Right. So that's
but
true.
That's not.
I mean,
but they may have only had one
specific
layer of clothing.
It depends on the situation.
But they said, even if you're, it says right here, even if you're wearing 10 layers, you rip all 10 layers down to your heart.
I'm not sure what the...
Yeah, you're right.
I think the practice may be different. Yeah. It might be different in different places. Mm-hmm. I think that we in general, we do... It just depends on what you're wearing. Like, if someone has an undershirt, so that you don't tear.
But you don't wear...
If
you have a man... Tzitzis
may or may not be included in the... Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. But the... Yeah.
I was recently unveiled, but there was a shirt that I wore all
right.
the time. But it was a question of if it was very cold, I might put that shirt on over a t-shirt.
Right.
Like when I get up on the third morning or the fourth morning, I'm putting that shirt on every day. But some days I may have been wearing it over a different shirt.
Right.
As well.
So
on a warmer day, I would only wear that shirt.
Right.
As an example, but I wasn't tearing the second item.
Right. You're right. So. It's true. I mean, I think this practice, in a certain, maybe it's only the initial time when you do the tearing at the beginning that you do that you do it all the way. I mean, for women, it becomes a little bit more complicated in terms of not tearing in such a way that you're. So that becomes a little bit complicated. Yeah, and I'm not sure even where t-shirts, like some sort of other kind of shirt, lies in terms of this kind of stuff. So I'm not 100% sure. Okay.
What I think is really interesting is how clever it was when you think about the psychology of people,
mm-hmm.
right? Because when you said, it's not like you tear it and then you show it. Everybody sees.
It's on the front,
mm-hmm.
right? It's
yeah.
on the front. You're supposed to see. Everybody's supposed to see it,
yeah.
which is so clever because it means that it doesn't allow the person to escape it,
mm-hmm.
which is so unhealthy.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's set up to help, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things
it would be easy to just retreat, right? Like, and just not go into yourself and not deal with it.
I think the laws of mourning, they're all psychological.
Aren't they? There's a lot
they
of
all are psychological.
Interesting.
Especially,
yeah.
I think, with the Kaddish.
Yeah.
Men, okay, it's obligated on the sons. So, but you're forced to go to shul to do it. Because I think, that's right.
Yes.
Otherwise, you'd be sitting in the house mourning.
Yes.
I think women in the house were busier because maybe there were children in the house, so they're more right. But men would just sit there, so they force them. You got to go to shul. You want to say this, you better get the shul to say it. So they force you out of the house.
They're clever.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's
Other thing, when a woman is captive during a war. And you want to marry her, you have to permit her time to mourn for her parents. So
correct.
One other thing that they add is let her nails grow long.
Correct.
Is that ever a part of Any literature that you've seen about?
In that context, the idea is that she's mourning,
yeah.
But also the idea is that she is
going
sort of, yes, coming in such a way that you will hopefully, go back on your decision to take this person captive and then marry
her. Oh, okay.
Right? So that's,
does it actually
that's
say that one is for mourning and one is for becoming ugly? Or hideous?
I have to check. I don't want to tell you offhand, but I know that's for sure how we interpret it.
Okay.
So everybody interprets that. Neither of those things are for mourning. It also says she has to do her hair, which in that case doesn't mean like do it nicely.
Mm-hmm.
It either might mean shave it off or grow it very long. That's what I meant when those two things are sometimes brought in tandem with each other. Okay, so that's one practice that I wanted to look at, which is Kriya. There's a lot more to be said about it, but at least we got some sort of perspective on where it came from and why we do it and what exactly it is. The other thing I wanted to look at, we'll see how much we can get through, and hopefully we can finish most of this though, is comforting mourners, Nichum Avelim or Tanchume Avelim. There's a practice that we have to try and comfort the mourner and try and help them. So the question is, again, where does this come from, and what exactly is it that we're doing, and how does this emerge in terms of the halakhas that we have? So in terms of the source, there's a little bit of debate, what level of requirement is this? Does the Torah mandate this? Is this something that was instituted later, that the rabbis instituted later? So in that respect, we have this Mishnah, which is in source 10. There is a halacha that, in general, if you're doing one mitzvah, you're involved in a mitzvah, you're exempt from having to stop doing that one and do something else. So, and this comes up a lot. The classic example, perhaps, is dealing with burying somebody that died. If you're dealing with burying the dead, then you don't have to do all kinds of other things that may come up in the meantime. So usually the tension here that's described is the tension between reading the Shema. It's time in the morning to read the Shema, that you have until, 3 hours in the day, whatever it is, to read the Shema, three sunlight hours, whatever, to read the Shema, but you're busy being involved burying a dead person, so do you have to stop? You don't have to stop to read the Shema. What happens if you already accomplished that? Now the body has been buried, the person is buried, and now the Mishnah describes that the people who buried the body came back, they ran back to greet the mourners as they were coming back into town, into their house. So what about reading Shema in that context? So here the Mishnah says, Kavru atamet, chazru. The people, they buried the body and they came back. If it's possible for them to begin and complete the Shema before the mourners arrive, what they used to do, we still do it now, it's just very minimized at the cemetery, is that the mourners come away from the grave and you have the people stand on both sides, you make like rows, and the mourners pass through in the middle. And then you offer words of consolation, consolement. They used to have a double row. The way that it was done in times of the Mishnah is you had an inner row and sort of like an outer row. So one group of people that directly faced the mourners and other people that were there also to show their solidarity, but they're standing one row behind. They didn't directly speak to the mourners. So if you get back and you're in this row and you can say the Shema quickly before the mourners come, then you should say it. But if you can't, im lav lo yatchil, you shouldn't start. Ha'omdim b'shura mibifnim p'turim v'chitzonim chayavim. In this double row, the people that are in the inside who will actually be speaking to the mourners, they're exempt from reading the Shema, and the people that are standing outside who are there just in terms of the effect of having a big crowd of people, but they won't actually be speaking to the mourners, they have to read the Shema. So what we see here, we won't read this next source inside, but I'll just tell you, you can read the English or read the Hebrew or whatever, that Rabbeinu Yonah says here, one of the medieval commentators says, oh, so you see that comforting the mourners is a mitzvah. Just like burying the dead was a mitzvah, it's going to exempt you from having to read the Shema. This is a mitzvah from the Torah, and he says it's based on the concept of gmilut chesed, of doing kindness for somebody else. The Rambam here as well.
By the way, is the Shema another word for mourning tefillah, shacharit?
No, just it's literally just the Shema. The Shema is a mitzvah by itself. Mm-hmm. Tefillah in the morning is a whole other can of worms, which I don't want to get into. But the Shema is for sure a mitzvah that you have to do in the morning. The Rambam says as well in the beginning, of, in a certain point in the laws of mourning, that you have there. He doesn't take this directly as an example of chesed. The Torah says you have to love your fellow as yourself. Maybe familiar with this catchphrase, "V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha," love your fellow as yourself. So the Rambam says that is a commandment from the Torah. And but it was sort of left, depending on how you read this, open-ended, or it wasn't defined. And later, the rabbis created a definition where they said that they described a whole long list of different things that you do that fit into this category. So you have some of them here. Visiting the sick, consoling mourners, providing hachnasat kala, which is to provide means for someone to get married, escorting visitors from your house when they visit you, in being involved in any elements of the burial, bringing joy to a bride and groom at the wedding. All of these things are things which the rabbi said, these are instances, this is how you do being kind to somebody else. So one of them
is...
We
read these every morning, too.
What?
We read these every morning in Shacharit.
Right, some of them are included. Yeah. So that's the idea. One way or another, exactly at what level it stands, but it derives from the notion that you have to do kindness for other people. The other person is suffering, they're grieving, and you want to go there and somehow say something to them, interact with them so that it can alleviate some of their suffering. Just like if they're sick, you want to try and go there and visit them and try to make them feel better. And if they're in a situation where they're getting married, so you want to go and make them feel as happy as possible, you want to try and make the person feel better. So that's the goal. But immediately, as soon as we start to look at these things, we discover that there's a big tension that emerges in terms of the goal that you have here, that you want to do this, and what you actually can say and do in these circumstances. And we see in source 13 that there's a lot of etiquette that is involved in the Shiva house. A lot of you have to be very careful when you speak and when you don't speak. Ein hamenachamim rishayim liftoach pihem ad sheyiftach ha'avel tchila. So the people that are consoling are not allowed to begin speaking until the mourner speaks to them first. How do we know? Again, we go back to example. Kedematzinu be'Iov, in the story of Iov, he has this situation where his family, bunch of really tragic things happen to him all at once, and then his friends come to visit him to console him, and it says that for days they didn't say anything because he didn't say anything. And then it says that he started to speak, and then they responded with whatever they had to say. So you see this from there. Kedematzinu be'Iov shenemar ve'ein dover lav davar. Nobody said anything to him. V'chtiv achareicha and patach Iov et piu. Afterwards it says Iov opened his mouth. V'hadar v'yan Eliphaz hatimani. And then afterwards Eliphaz hatimani, which was one of Iov's friends that came, started to speak. That's one rule. Another rule, Kesheroin Hamenachamim Shavel Poteratam, Einan Rashain Leshevetzlov. When the consolers see that the mourner has sort of dismissed them, he said, okay, and it's clear the conversation has ended, then they're not allowed to stay there. They have to leave. That's also part of the etiquette. So there's a lot of tension here. You want to come and say whatever you can say, whatever you can say to make the person feel better, but we also see that you're not really supposed to try and jump into this. You have to give the mourner space. This is a lot about giving the mourner space. And there's also a strong element of silence, of just being quiet in the base aval. We'll flip a little bit in the sources. If you go to source 16, we see that this is true.
It almost seems, though, that actions speak louder than words in this case.
Oh, so, yeah.
Even the presence perhaps speaks, right. It speaks more than anything a person could say.
Right.
You show up. Yeah. I know, but, people aren't sort of resistant and you go and you're sitting there and you're not saying anything. It's kind of awkward.
Yes.
Because if they don't speak, they don't know.
Right.
Or they may not be accustomed to that kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is important for, that's true.
Partying all around.
No, but there's also...
Yeah.
I've seen it on both ends where people just come and everybody's talking about, I don't know what, the Blue Jays. How about them Blue Jays?
Yeah. Not a party.
No.
You're right.
No.
That's also something which is part of it, that to talk about...
The Avel is participating in that, which maybe that's what they feel like doing. That's,
right.
That's one thing, but if you're sitting around and it's like, well, I don't really know what to say and I have no... So why don't I talk to you about, last week's dinner or something. It's like,
yeah,
right. Right, so that's another important part of it.
Because nobody likes awkward silence.
I know.
It's like, it's not coming to a bad place. It's
right. So this, but we do see that this is exactly to this point, that silence is very important. It's a value. If you look in source 16, the Gemara says, Garcina and Bebracha, the Gemara says in Bracha, that Marzutra says, Agra de Vetame Shtikuta, the reward for, it's interesting phrase, the house of impurity, but it means a house where there was a dead body, a house where they were sitting Shiva. Perush Schar Shel Beit Avel, the reward for the mourner's house is silence. She'asru lo leharbot varim. The mourner himself should not speak a lot. She'im marbet varim nireh kamisha shachach tzaro. Because if the person is talking and talking and talking, it looks like they're a person that forgot their pain. Ve'eno nireh ka'aval. And he doesn't appear to be like a mourner. But I think part of the idea here is that the grieving process is an internal emotional process. And a lot of times we like to objectify stuff by trying to define it, by talking about it, by whatever, or even simply to be distracted by talking about something. And the idea here seems to be that silence has a very valuable place inside of the Shiva, inside the Beit Avel. So we're faced with this kind of tension. On the one hand, you want to come in and say something, and in fact, some poskim write that you should think about it carefully. What can I say to this person in terms of my relationship, in terms of what I know about them? Something that's not going to be inappropriate, something that's not going to be... What can I say that can be effective in terms of making them feel better? On the other hand, we have this idea of silence being a value. You want there to be some amount of silence. So what we discover, what comes out of this, is something that we just mentioned before. What about just coming, and like, what happens? In theory, you just follow these rules, you come, and the Avel says nothing. He doesn't allow you to speak. So you're sitting there, and you wait, he does not engage you in conversation, and then you go. And the whole visit was silent. So does that even count? Did we do anything there? So we see that perhaps yes.
But you do have to say you have to start with a hamakom.
Yeah, so exactly.
Even as you leave.
Right, as you leave.
You could be silent, but you've said something by saying that.
Right, you are allowed to say that. Yeah. Even if they didn't say anything to you, you're allowed to say that. Yeah, that's for sure. So that'll be the last point. But we see here, just an interesting description. In source 14, the tour is describing the Avel going to shul on Shabbos, and afterwards they would console him. We do it in shul also at a different point, but this is what he describes. Some people did this. We'll just read in English just to go faster. After prayers, the mourner leaves first and sits in front of the synagogue, and the community comes after him and sits with him. Then the mourner gets up and goes to his home, and the community follows him and sits there for a while. Those who have this practice rely on it. Very interesting, a Gadic passage in the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. King Solomon saw that doing acts of kindness was important to God. Therefore, when he built the temple, he included two gates, one for grooms and one for mourners and the excommunicated. On Shabbat, Israel, meaning people, would walk between these gates. There would be people there, and then they said one thing to the groom. But when one entered through the gate of mourners with his lip covered, so this relates back to this idea of having it as a social broadcasting in society that I'm doing mourning. One of the practices that they used to do, which we don't do today, was called Ituf HaRosh, where you would cover your head and all the way maybe down over your eyes. You just have like a hood on kind of idea. That was also a public sign of mourning, which we don't really do now. So he came with his lip covered, they would know that he was a mourner and say to him, "May the one who dwells in this house console you." HaShochein B'Bayit Zeh Yinachemecha. So on this basis, this commentator in source 15, he asked the question that we asked before. What we do, or what apparently they used to do, it used to happen more commonly in his day, and what could theoretically happen and sometimes does now, where you don't say anything, it's just a silent visit, is that anything? Is there value there? So he says, since he does not write that they sit with the mourner and offer words of consolation, right? The Torah just says they fall into his house, they sit there for a while, and then they go. And instead writes in the end that they say, "May the one who dwells in this house console you." There is some support here for our practice of consoling today, where generally the mourner does not say anything. The consolers come to him and sit for a while, and then say, "May God console you with the other mourners of Zion," similar to what we say today. Hashem yinachamecha im shara vele tzion. And one may have wondered, is this really called consoling the bereaved? But from here, there is some support that coming into the mourner and sitting for the sake of his honor is called consoling the bereaved. That just sitting there, it has a value. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because you know one should not be studying Torah if you're an avol. So the point of the matter is, if you want to avoid talking in gossip or whatever it is, one should be talking Torah. But since you can't do that, it almost gives you sort of pause to. What are you going to talk about? Can't talk about the weather. I mean, it's banal, but if you can't talk about Torah, then really what else should you be talking about?
Yes, maybe you talk about nothing. You talk about whatever the mourner wants to talk about.
You have to really take the lead of the mourner.
I know.
And you
I think you have to evaluate who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who's the mourner and what's the situation.
And sometimes they
want to
talk about the
yeah.
mourner.
Yeah.
And
they
sometimes
feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You can tell.
So
I've seen this.
Yeah.
Where somebody comes in and they're very religious, and I know they're trying to do good, right?
Yeah.
Like they're trying to do it right.
Yeah.
You know, but it can seem very
awkward.
Especially if somebody's not an observant that's receiving it. So I think you have to be very sensitive to the situation.
What about the idea of having? I know this is a bit of a tangent, but having kids there. Below a certain age. For example, my mother's cousin in Morocco, and she would never, you'd never see kids at a cemetery. Is there any halacha behind that? It's just custom.
I'm not 100% sure.
So also pregnant women.
That somebody told me.
When she was pregnant, she was not able to go to a...
So I'm going to bring in Rabbi Stern.
Okay.
Because
please.
I was in that position 25 years ago. So
you're not allowed to go to
but no, no. So my
no,
dear,
a cemetery.
My closest friend's mother passed away. Whatever. And then whatever time later, they were doing an unveiling. So my friend called me and she said, "Listen, I'm telling you, we're doing the unveiling on next Sunday, but I know you're not coming because I was visibly pregnant." So I said, "What do you mean I'm not coming? I know nothing from this." And she said, "No. It's you're not coming." She's not particularly observant, but there's a lot of tradition. Anyway, I asked around. Nobody seemed to know. Is this a minhag or is this halakha? Why can't I go to comfort my friend at her mother's unveiling? So I finally went to Rabbi Stern, who said, "Well, you shouldn't go, and the reason you shouldn't go is because you should not endanger the baby. And if you are going to go to a cemetery, never mind Ayin Hara, but if you're going to go to a cemetery and be overcome with emotion and pass out, you could harm your baby. Therefore, a pregnant woman doesn't go to a cemetery for that reason." I said, "Oh, so I shouldn't go." He says, "No, you shouldn't go." I said, "Well, what if I feel terrible that I'm not going? I feel worse not going." He says, "Then you go."
Yeah,
I said,
yes,
"So."
He said,
"But you have an absolute out if you don't feel comfortable to go. You absolutely are within your rights not to go. If you would prefer to go, if you feel better doing that, by all means," he says, "given that it's an unveiling and not a funeral."
With my wife's, it was like a custom.
It's become a custom. Mix in a lot of superstition all the time.
I'll tell you a story.
I'm just coming straight from the rabbi who said, and I went. But he also said that had it been a funeral, maybe not so much. This is more emotional. This is already an unveiling.
I'll tell you a story. I was to a funeral on. To the Shloim Inyan on Lawrence. What? Yeah. No, but it's to do with customs.
Yeah.
The woman passed away, left three daughters and a son. Salas and Hora.
All right, yellow.
Okay. So when it came time after the service to go to the cemetery, the daughters were not allowed to go. Because their custom was not the only men go.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
a lot of them.
Yeah, it's
a lot of them.
I've seen one from our very shul here, where a husband passed away and the wife did not go to the cemetery.
A lot of Hasidus don't do that. Yeah, they don't.
So I think all the stuff, most of this stuff, is all custom.
Yeah.
You go over the hill to the next town. They do it a different way.
It's what I said at the beginning. There's a lot of custom. One last point about this this thing. Just the statement that we make that you actually make when you console the mourner. Hamakom yinachem etchem betoch shar veilei tzion v'yerushalayim. So it's very strange. Why is that what we say? Why don't we say, I feel so sorry, or I'm sorry for your loss, something like, why do you say God should console you? In the Sephardi minhag, I think it's even more direct. It's just tenachamu min hashamayim. Just have consolation from heaven. Nothing about Jerusalem. It's very direct. So what is this? So one of my teachers, Rabbi Aaron Kahn, said that the idea here is perhaps this: that in order to really be able to console somebody, you really have to be able to empathize, and they have to know that you can empathize with their situation. And somebody that's suffering, if I'm grieving and someone comes and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry," so it's very nice of them and I appreciate it, but at a certain level, like, you don't know what I'm going through right now, you don't know what I'm experiencing right now, you're not in this with me, so I accept it, but there's only so far it can go. And so part of this idea of silence perhaps is a recognition that there's only so much you can try and say and do. You can't really do it. You can't really console the person because you're not really together with them 100% in terms of their suffering. The only one that can understand this, that we know understands this, is God. God understands exactly where the person is, and God can provide situations of consolation. So at a certain level, you just say, even if you're totally silent, there's nothing I can say. Hamakom yinachem etchem. God can, hopefully, you pray that God will help the person, even if you can't totally do it yourself.
It also avoids you screwing up by saying something you shouldn't. So this is almost like a go-to.
It's scripted, and it's...
Yep.
So again, this should be a Aliyat Neshama for my grandfather.
Amen.
Thank you.